exclusively on CBS All Access. A Legend returns.
I have a mission. There's not a hell of a chance for somebody to stop me.
Patrick Stewart in Star Trek Picard. Now streaming only on CBS All Access.
Welcome to the Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Dominic Patton, senior editor and chief TV critic for Deadline Hollywood.
And I'm Jeff Boucher, the genre editor at Deadline.
It's the beginning of February, and we are already beginning to feel the ends of winter, we hope, to some of you. And we're beginning to see some blossoming happening on CBS All Access Picard. If you watched the episode last that dropped just after midnight this morning, we have some treats for you. If you didn't watch it, as I have said now the previous two times, and I probably will say every week, you might want to step back for a couple of hours, take a look at it, and then come back to us, because we have spoilers deluxe coming your way for the episode that was known as The End is the Beginning. And let me tell you, the end was surely a beginning for some of us.
Absolutely. And we have some great guests with us today. We have Alex Kurtzman, who's back, who is the executive producer of the show. We have Kirsten Byers, who's the supervising producer and co-creator of the show. And we also have Hanalei Culpepper, who directed the first three episodes.
So please join us as we take off into Federation space and beyond for more Star Trek Picard. I would love to start off, if we could, talking about how this was kind of the episode that you didn't. This was like the late edition ad, and like you came in to make two into three.
Well, the truth is, it's not the late edition ad. The edition stuff is Pepper throughout.
There's
a little bit in episode one. There's a lot in episode two, and then I feel like episode three is predominantly what was episode two. I believe it starts correctly. It kind of starts with us going to the apartment and to Dodge's.
In two. That was in two. That's the top of episode two.
For three, going back and seeing the moment that Picard submitted his resignation and and they accepted it. That scene of him telling her that was new stuff, which originally was in, I think, episode two. Back in the script phase, and then taken out, and then brought back when we've shot more stuff. So the bulk of it, the creation of the investigation, the back and forth cross-cutting between the interrogation and Dodge talking to Rhonda, all of that was originally episode two. And it just kind of got shoved down.
Obviously, in any situation, making a modern television show, there's, you know, you're just like, well, we thought we had this location and we don't, so we're going to do this, we're going to do that. There's always a little Frankensteining. There's always stitching. There's always weaving and just like having to hustle as you go. But with this, does it feel like as you these early episodes, because you're bringing back this iconic character, you're developing this new story, there's a new tone, there's this and that. Did it kind of spin your guys' heads a little bit to be like, okay, so where is he now? What's happening?
It's interesting because I feel like I'm pretty good at keeping enormous amounts of information in my head linearly, and that one really blew my brains out. Like it really did, because we began to identify that there were certain things you needed to see to fully understand. Otherwise, people were referencing things that you didn't, as I said, didn't feel, right? And then you go, and you're shooting, right? So now you're shooting, and you're going backwards, and you're saying, wait a minute, what gaps do we need to fill in for full clarity?
There's a Jenga quality to it.
It really was. And there's a lot of really big brains on the show, and we all together were like, wait, so remind me what Hanalei just did. We were all like that all the time. And
you're like, is that Google Doc number 17 or 17.7?
Exactly. You have no idea how many docs there were. I mean, to make sure we were keeping track of everything. And then, you know, we go into editing and we watch it and we're like, okay, what are we missing? Oh, you know what would be great? Here's two lines of dialogue. Let's just pick that up in a close-up. We would do some of that later. You know, it's a very fluid process. It got a lot less fluid, actually, as the season went on. It was really the first three because we were landing so much ground at the beginning. But it was it really was a challenge to keep all that straight.
And it's a complex story. You know, I mean, it's leading into complex things. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that people could scratch their head if it's not all. If the dominoes don't, if you're missing a domino, they're not going
to
fall.
Well, I sort of feel that's okay, to be honest. I feel like
I think we felt it was okay.
Yeah,
too.
I feel yeah. if you're talking to an audience in 2020, yeah. It's like, you know who the audience are. Like, I don't know what that is. Oh, look, Wikipedia says that. That's like, you know, like people. That's how people interact. So I feel like the old style, which I guess a lot of us grew up with, is like, okay, so this is happening. Robert McGee says, Act One.
Totally.
I'm like, you don't, well, just don't need
but to. as a director, I don't want them to pause and go to Google. They just be so engaged they can't pull away. Maybe they make a little mental note to Google later, but yeah.
But what's interesting when you talk about McGee, and look, I maintain that no matter what streaming and film has brought us now, which is, I think, I think that the things that are successful are the things that don't work as a formula. But what I think you have to know the formula in order to know how to break the rules, and I've always believed that. And one of the things that's really interesting that I really like about the what we came to is that typically you would show the Mars attack as a baseline, and then you would operate outward from there. In this case, they talk about it, you're left to imagine it, and then it's not until episode two that you show it. In episode two, you meet Rafi, you begin to understand, oh, they have a history, but you don't really understand what it is until the beginning of episode three. And that's a very, it's not linear, but it's the puzzle to me as a viewer is more interesting.
Yeah. You know, I remember I talked to Michael Mann once about this, and I said, what's the biggest difference between filmmaking now and when you started? And it could be like a practical difference, or it could be more philosophical. And he said, people start movies in the middle of conversations now, and the audience has reached a level of sophistication and acquaintance with story dynamics that they'll go along with it and or they won't. But you can do that. And he goes, when I start, you start at the beginning, you tell people what's going to happen, then you just do it. And he said, you know, it's really, really invigorating and surprising because it's like watching literature change. You know, it's like the postmodern thing.
Which can be good and bad.
Yeah. But do you guys ever, does it ever reach a point where it's like Kubrick with 2001? He's like, no, it's too easy to understand. Take things out. You know, like, I mean, he actually purposely injected ambiguity to kind of create this epic feel.
In this case, I don't think we ever had a need to do that. Like, we knew from the beginning, you know, once we had the story set, kind of how big and massive this was going to be. And I think there was a, you know, as we were getting toward the end, a sense that we just had too much left to explain. Yeah. And that's why it really made sense.
You mean when you get into towards the end of the story?
Toward episode 7 and 8,
oh, okay.
In that area.
So
and we were like we had sort of scheduled, you sort of knew when certain cards were going to turn over and things were going to drop. And to get there and feel like, oh, wait, no, like they don't have a firm enough grounding in this piece of the mythology yet, even though we always knew that's what we were doing and where we were going.
Right. So you had to lace it through.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like it's a bigger story to keep in your head at all times. I think of it the way I think of my novels as opposed to an individual episode. Right. And it's a very easy thing when you're writing a book to go, oh, wait, it's chapter three. You know, I need to go back and lay that in. It's a much bigger deal. But also was really, really critical.
It's a lot less expensive in the novel.
Yeah, sorry.
But to that,
in your heart.
I actually want to start. This is a classic ploy, but I actually want to start at the end because he says the famous word, and it. I got to tell you, from episode one, I know that I am not alone. We were all waiting, right? And it's very interesting when we get to that stage. And I want to get a sense from you guys about that. When Jean-Luc says engage, it's different. It's not that what was that?
One of the things that we learned on the 2009 movie, which carried all the same expectations, right? You're waiting for Scotty to say, I can't keep it together. You're waiting for Spot. Like, all of those things.
God damn it, Jim.
You know, I'm giving her all she's got, Captain. Every, you know, damn it, man, I'm a doctor, not a fill in the blank.
Yeah.
The trick that I think Bob and I learned at the time was do it at the moment when you least expect it in a way that's least expected, right? And then it's very delightful and satisfying when it comes. And I think we felt similarly that if Picard walked on screen and said, make it so, or engage, you'd be like, I got nowhere to go. Like,
done.
I might as well cancel my subscription now because I just got
what
I paid for.
That's an excellent Star Trek short. I love it. Really short.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Terrific. It's like every Star Wars movie, they could just reduce it to, I've got a bad feeling about this.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah. But
did you consider him not having him not do it?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh,
for sure. It feels like you guys have broken so many of those rules.
Make no mistake. Patrick started by saying, I won't say the lines. I won't be in a uniform. I won't do the Borg. I mean, it started with all of that. And I think, you know, it was a great thing that he did that because what he was really saying was, I'm throwing down the gauntlet for you to come up with something new and fresh. Mm-hmm. And if by the time I feel satisfied in that regard, then I'll throw in and make it so. You know what I mean? Wow. And I don't know even if that was conscious on his part, but that's certainly what the effect was.
But do you know what was funny that day? We're all, you know, we're all looking forward to him saying it too because he's just sure. Part of it. We're all
fans.
Moment.
Yeah.
And I want to make that shot as heroic as possible. And he really wanted to hold the bag with the bread, and the bread was sticking out. And I was like, can we eat? He's like, I really want the bag of the bread because that took away it from being like your regular engaged. It made sure. It brought it back down to who he is now. He's there with the bread that Dajay Bong.
He's much more domestic now. Like, so he goes to get coffee. He's like, make it soy.
There's something that I love so much about the way Hanalei directed that moment, and it's a meta moment that doesn't really announce itself as a meta moment, but you've now gone through three episodes and you finally get to that moment and he says, okay, and everyone takes their seats and they turn to him as if they were the audience saying, are you going to say it now? And then he goes, all right, you know, engage, you know, and the camera's kind of waiting for it too. And it's suddenly like you are, I just thought it was such a lovely sort of tip of the hat to, yes, now we're going to give you what you paid for.
Because everybody right. on the crew, you know, they've watched the holodeck replays of the shows.
Yeah.
But I always think that that's such a, you know, that maybe is the wrong word, but it feels like sometimes it can be a real burden. You know, when you have a franchise, or you have a revival, or you have an
sure,
iconic character, it's like, man, we got to get, he's got to do the thing.
Well, it's that's a burden because if you fuck it up, and you do it in a way that's not satisfying, you've now...
It's cloying.
You've now, like, sullied something that people love.
Yeah, and or it can become, like, a museum piece, you know? Like, you know, like, if you... I went on the set of Superman Returns, the Bryan Singer movie, and, you know, he was using the John Williams music, and he was doing all these things, calling back to Christopher Reeve, like...
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, like, boy, you got to be careful because this is going to turn into a museum piece at some point. Like, you're afraid to break anything. You're also afraid to make it, you know, do stuff. You know, like, you got to be able to, you know, willing to break the Enterprise.
Yeah.
You know,
And speaking of breaking, I mean, that's what the Borg cube is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the broken thread. And we spent a lot of time in this episode on that cube.
Mm-hmm.
We learn a lot. And that, you know, I guess it's sort of an interrogation chamber that Hugh takes her into, and we start learning from the cards and all sorts of things. Give us a sense of that, because it was, you know, there are elements of this, and I think, Alex, you've talked about this before, and it's kind of inevitable when you're talking about Patrick because of his stage career. There's a great stage feeling about this sometimes, where it's like, they're not set pieces, but they're like, we're just going to let this is people talking and things happening. Because that's.
I feel like isn't that one of the most defining characteristics of Star Trek, and isn't it why it's so beloved? In fact, I feel like the debate is always: is it action or is it character and philosophy? And I would say more people fall on the side of character and philosophy than action, even though the movies and the shows have a lot of them, all of them.
As is this,
not just ours. Yeah, but it's a question of balance, right? It's how much what's the ratio of action to character and philosophy, and look, none of us want to throw in an action scene just to have it. It has to move the story forward in the way that a good musical, the musical number moved the story forward, or the song shouldn't be there, you know? And I think that the beauty of streaming television now is that you can say, I'm going to write an 8-minute scene and I'm not going to cut it. And if the scene's good enough, and if the elements in the scene are electric enough, then people will sit and they'll want to watch it. It's a harder thing to do in a movie.
Captain Rios?
Oh, hi. Hello.
Picard.
Yes, sorry, of course you are. I'm afraid you might be too late. Right then, come on. So, what seems to be the problem?
Are you kidding me? Hey!
Are you?
Chris Rios is just an EMH. Just?
I
know who you are. I read one of your books one time.
What happened to you?
I didn't die. Medkit. Aguardiente.
No thanks.
What you want to do is take the giant hunk of tritanium shrapnel out of the hole in my shoulder. That's just a guess. Please, sit.
And where are we at? Now we're learning about the destroyer. Now we're learning about what the stakes are outside of Jean-Luc's life and failures and resurrection and sense of guilt. We're going to larger places, and it feels like we are, I guess it's inevitable, we're starting to bump against canon in original ways. Mm-hmm. There are like things here where you're like, this is not my next generation. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean my next generation didn't happen. You know, and stuff like I wanted to get the notion of, so what do you do with a character like that? With, you know, Bruce Maddox might have created the end of the universe. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Well, he always had it in him, didn't he? I mean, he wanted to take Data apart piece by piece. You know, I think about the Romulans and how
you
little...
You said that in such a loving way.
Well, yeah. But,
I hear some things about the Romulans a lot.
But honestly, how little we really knew about them. That was the thing we kept coming up against as we were trying to go as deep as possible into each character and into each element of story, right? We knew they were sort of secretive. We knew they were no fun to necessarily be, very defensive, very much on their side of the wall, right, or the neutral zone.
Well, see, that's funny. When I was a kid, I always thought the Romulans were Mao's China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Klingons were Soviet Russia.
Yeah.
You know, of course.
So then,
Starfleet was America.
So then, because we're us and we're super geeks about this, the question we ask is why? How did that particular culture develop that thing? And is there any way to actually make that real in our story in a meaningful way? And so all of these important things that we're starting to learn actually come from something that is quite old and foundational. And we're going to get more of it as we go along. But that was really the challenge, right? To allow the Romulans to be who we've always known them to be, but to provide more new, exciting, compelling information that makes you go, oh, God, yeah, of course. You know?
But in there, you know, are the Romulans a treat or a bit of a weight? Because they're the Romulan. I mean, you know, the Klingons are, I'm not going to say it's easy, but they come and they do their stuff, right? And certainly we've seen on Discovery a great portion of that. But the Romulans are mysterious and threatening, but also oblique. Like a Romulan greeting, having watched so many episodes of the various shows, like it's like, is that a hello or a get the fuck away from me? Like, I'm not quite sure what that is.
There is no definition for that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, does that give you opportunity or does that limit opportunity?
It gives you opportunity.
Oh, yeah, for
they're
sure.
They're a treat.
How can we never see them drunk, though? How can we never see them drunk? Because they have Romulan ale. I mean, these guys should all be drunk.
That's the secret of Romulan ale. Everybody gets drunk but them.
I think Romulans, from a writing point of view, are so interesting because their entire culture is based on secrecy, right? So if you're doing it, we start veering into what almost feels like a spy thriller when you're on the cube. And Romulans are perfect for that, you know? And the idea that Soji has to figure out a way to approach a former Romulan who then was assimilated by Borg and is now basically schizophrenic means that she has to know about, even though Romda says, I hate the word mythology, she has to know enough about Romulan mythology and secrecy to know how to approach her, right? So suddenly she becomes a puzzle box. She becomes a really interesting problem for our characters to solve. And I think that you'll see over the course of the season that not only is Romulan secrecy a really big part of what is connected to the Destroyer and the mythology of the Destroyer, but where we're going by the ending. And what that mythology actually is and how deeply it's embedded in Romulan culture.
We're now far enough in that I feel we can talk about this openly as friends. Like, you guys brought the Borg back, and that's a huge deal for any part of the Star Trek canon, but especially with Picard. So if the Romulans are you know, a burden, or there's mystery within mystery, or is that opportunity, what does the Borg represent for that? Because the Borg is like, you know, people, you've got people like me who are like, you know, as I've said, 2.5 hours of the greatest television ever made, right? So, like, you're going to beat that?
Well, I think Kirsten is going to be able to give a more articulate answer to I guess what the implications are from a fan point of view about bringing the Borg back. But what I can tell you was really significant to us was that we were really not repeating, and I'm being cryptic because in future episodes a lot more will be revealed, but we're not,
which means on future podcasts,
which is, I can't wait. What the show is going to do is it's going to give you a totally different perspective on the Borg than you've had before. And I think, without revealing too much, in keeping with the spirit of what is so beautiful about Roddenberry's vision, you know, where the monster actually suddenly becomes the friend, we're going to be turning a little bit away from the Borg that you've met on the series and in the films to a reminder that they were former species that were assimilated, mm-hmm. just like Picard. And there's a humanistic approach to the story from that point of view.
It's like the young soldiers pressed into duty, you know, that we've seen all over the world, especially in places like Africa. You know,
yep.
like we're the first victim is the person that's holding the gun.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, that's something interesting to kind of, we use the word interesting way too much. That's remarkable.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. Please, thesaurus, help us. Also, we're seeing press into service. We're now, our motley crew has been pulled together.
Not entirely. Oh, yes, by not entirely.
We're close.
We're very close.
We're close.
Yeah. We're working on one.
Yeah. We're working.
Yeah, we're working.
And we've seen the first kind of, besides Data and opening the drawers with Hugh, we've seen the first kind of blast from the past in a sense like that, right? Personalized one. I mean, clearly larger characters, obviously, and species. This is happening in a very organic way. These are not flashed in the sky. Or in traditional television, like, stay tuned after this commercial, big cameo coming up. How the process of this is this laying a pace, or is this, we're just getting there and then we're speeding up? And again, no spoilers or future podcasts.
I think to defy all the conventions, as you say, of formula of, you know, what you're talking about is sort of like, let's create a platform for the introduction of a character, as opposed to introduce the character when the story says, now I need you to see the story from this person's point of view. And that determined everything, that every decision that we made was from that place. And I think it was probably born of the fact that Patrick was understandably and correctly so allergic to bringing in cast just to have them be there for fan service. It meant that every time they entered into the story, the story was now pivoting toward that character for a reason. And it was great. I mean, I love that there's not a lot of fanfare, you know?
Yeah, well, it makes, for me, it adds to the sort of verisimilitude of the universe, right? All these people exist at the same time. Just because we never saw them on the same shows interacting, they all had lives that were continuing. And so it's fan service in the sense that people are going to see those folks and be, oh, wait, I remember. Did that? How many times did we, and, you know, but it's also like we try to look always at the reality of the world. Who would be working at Daystrom? Like, what would their job be? What are their days like?
Do you get discount cards at Free Cloud?
I don't. Rafi does. It's just trying to make it always seem more real than it ever did before.
It's kind of like putting together a Rolling Stones set list at this point, too.
Yeah.
You know, because like
that's the master analogy so far.
Well, I think we need,
you got to play the
tumbling dice.
Yeah.
Jonathan Frakes.
But also to that, though, I mean, you all, there's, and this was something that I really enjoyed, because as much as you're dealing with Patrick and Cannon and bringing all these things in, you then bring in Santiago's character. And it's like Santiago's characters, because you have this great hologram that really is like, it's kind of like there's the rogue captain, but there's Laurel and Hardy happening simultaneously. And I love that.
Santiago, I had the great privilege of working with him on our show Salvation that went two seasons. And Santiago came to work one day on that show in full makeup as an old man. And the rest of his cast did not know it was him. Whoa. And it's all on video, until he sprung, "Hey guys, it's me." And they were like, "Who is this crazy person? This old crazy person who's..." And they were totally blown away. And I think, whether I didn't realize it, but that planted the seed for all of us of the fact that he's a chameleon, mm-hmm. and that he can do so many things. And we asked him, "So what kind of accents can you do?" And he was like, "Well, which one do you want?" And suddenly the character began emerging. And you'll see that it isn't a gimmick. There's actually a reason that all the Hollows are programmed with different facets of his personality. That'll play out later.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. He's very popular in my household too, but I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah.
There are also, there's a very attractive look, and I know I'm pounding this a little bit, but I think you did a great job on those three episodes as a director. I really do. And I think we should all applaud it, and I think we should note it. And I also want to get a sense of, in this sense, is this is the kind of the end of the trilogy of those ones. How did that feel for you in telling the story, which really, you know, that's just the story. You're delivering it to us.
It's a responsibility.
Beginning. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. No, I definitely felt the weight of it, you know, every day. I enjoyed the process. It was really great. I mean, even though I was a Next Generation fan, I feel like I was the casual viewer fan. Like, I didn't do, like, such a deep dive. And so it was great to go back to the series that I loved and do the deep dive and learn even more and bring all these, you know, bring all the stuff back to the surface of what I had experienced emotionally watching the Next Generation. And in doing this. And so as a fan, you know, I wanted to make sure it was good to please people like me, to please people like you guys. It was my first pilot, so there's all the weight of that and what that's going to mean for your career. And I recognize
means
that...
thumbs up. I'm a TV critic. I get to say that. I get paid for it. No, it's true. Like, that's true. I didn't know that. I didn't know it was your first pilot. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, for Alex and the Secret Hideout team and for CBS All Access to take that risk on me, I mean, that's really showed a lot of faith. And so it's like, you can't, let them down. So it's, you know, it's really, I'm just forever grateful. It truly was a game changer.
But you, I mean, I feel that the visual palette is so well set now that three episodes in, that we know who these people are and the, I guess, worlds or galaxies they live in. By that.
And the stakes. Yeah. You know, we know the stakes. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it hard to disengage, so to speak?
Ouch!
But it's true. It is very hard to disengage. Because it was my first pilot, it was the first time that I gave birth to a show. Yeah. I told Alex that basically I'll be his surrogate for what he had. And you know, it was hard to let that child go, and now, you know, other directors come in and do their thing, and you know, I went off and I shot Discovery and some other stuff, and so, you know, I kind of wanted to be here just all the time until they kicked me out, you know. So it was very hard to have this baby and then let it go and let it thrive, and now it's off to the
college.
World.
Yeah.
It's so easy to have Hanalei around because she's so collaborative. You know, I mean, I can't wait for people to see the episode of Discovery that she did this season, where it's not really a spoiler because it's in the teaser, but we go to Trill. And again, that's another sort of world building or rebuilding thing. And it's such a beautiful emotional episode. And, you know, I love working with Hanalei because you started on season one of Discovery, so
yes.
It's been years now, you know, so there's like a real shorthand and a real understanding of certain things that, and I was very excited because I think I had more confidence in Hanalei than Hanalei for the pilot. I just knew she was going to kill it.
That's great.
Yeah.
They say in science that if you can do something three times, it's a fact. So this is the end of our third podcast. It's the third episode of Star Trek Picard. So I think we can honestly say this looks like it's real.
That's a fact.
So we will be back next week, as we are every week, at 2 p.m. Pacific time. We're going to be back with some great guests. And we have some really, really special guests next week. So you might want to hang around.
And that's a fact.